guest of honour, Alison Gopnik. But for the first session today, I'm delighted to introduce Peter Godfrey Smith, who I suspect needs no introduction to most of you. I'm also delighted to announce some news which is apparently just hot off the email a few minutes ago, which is that Peter's just been awarded the Lakatos Prize. I think perhaps a round of congratulations might be in order. Peter's going to be speaking to us on the philosophical imagination and the analysis of causation. Peter, welcome.
Great, thanks.
What I thought I would do today is give a very foundational talk for the most part with some concrete illustrations, but trying to look at the big picture. So question we might start with is what does it mean to try to give a philosophical analysis or philosophical treatment of something like causation or knowledge, truth, moral goodness, and so on? Especially when doing philosophy in the contemporary analytic style. And I think one way to start is to imagine a kind of ideal, a very impractical ideal, which I'll understand in terms of four elements, which I'm just going to number. I'm not going to give them names, but just sort of number them 1, 2, and 3, and then eventually 4. So one part of an ideal that we might try for is a complete description of the use of a term and the practices surrounding the use of a term, like cause, or like no, or like good, or true, or whatever. Also a description of the role played by whatever psychological basis there is behind the use of a term. So if you believe in concepts, then the role played by a concept. A complete psychology, a complete linguistics, and a complete sociology surrounding the contested terms, where this ideal description would include its practice among all kinds of people, not just philosophers. It would include cultural variation. And it would give you the complete story about attributions and use of a concept like knowledge or causation or truth. A second part of the ideal would be a description of an aspect of the world. Roughly speaking, the aspect or the part of the world or the set of phenomena that it looks like, in some sense, the concept in question or the term is intended to deal with. And when we describe this part of the world, we use whatever language we find useful. We're not bound to use any particular vocabulary. It's probably smart in some ways to avoid too much use of the term itself that we were talking about in Project 1, but if we find we have to use it, then fine. Either way, we try to give an account of some part of the world that the term and the concept are directed upon. And a third project is then an account of how the first and second sets of facts are related. So the kind of question we could ask here is a question like this. Has the concept picked out a natural kind? So when people use the word cause or the word no, are they using a natural kind term which has successfully picked out something in the world which we can regard as a natural kind? In contrast, might it turn out that when people use the word cause or no, that they're making some factual error, something like the factual error that John Mackey thought people were making when they used ordinary terms used to describe moral value? So we've got three projects, Project 1, Project 2, and Project 3, and I'll just talk about facts of the first type, second type, and third type. Now, these are all descriptive projects, and as I understand it, 1 and 2 are both empirical and contingent matters, at least in principle. And facts of the third kind follow from facts of the first two kinds. So in some sense, 3 is concerned with necessary relationships between the things we described in Project 1 and Project 2. But there are aspects of the... there are facts of the third kind, or at least aspects of the third project, where we can gain observational evidence. So, for example, whether or not a concept's use seems to be stable and successful. That's a fact of type 3, as I understand it. It isn't a fact about usage. It's a consequence of facts about usage with the way the world is that will generate success and stability. So it's a fact of type 3, but it might sometimes be more easy to observe the fact of success and stability than to observe the particular details regarding usage and the way the world works that give rise to that success. So 1 and 2 are contingent empirical matters. 3 is in some sense necessary because it concerns relationships between 1 and 2. With respect to the second project, I don't think of this merely as reciting the output of raw science, just sort of listing a bunch of things that scientists say, especially because scientists' descriptions of the world are often full of metaphor, language that's artificially sharpening things up. Scientists' language is often full of idealization, sometimes full of bad philosophy. So I think of Project 2 as an attempt to work out what the real message is of disparate parts of science that bear on the part of the world that we're concerned with. So in the case of causation, we've got an account of how people use the word cause, how they think causally. We've got an account of what seems to make the world run, what kinds of real relationships there are between whatever we think there is in the world. And Project 3 is an account of how these two things are related. Now, one obvious way of doing Project 3 is to engage in something like role-occupant analysis of the sort seen in the Canberra Plan. And that is one way of carrying out the third project. But I want to emphasize it's not the only way. So, for example, suppose you are a non-cognitivist about moral value. Suppose you're an emotivist of a very simple kind. Then you're not going to be able to give a role-occupant analysis. There are no real-world occupants that fit a role specified by ordinary moral terms, but you can engage in the third kind of project. What you would want to do is say something about the particular features of human social life that sustain the use of a particular kind of moral language. So role-occupant analysis and reference as a relation between words and the world more generally are just one option, one way in which you might be, one form that Project 3 might take. One further comment about role occupant analysis. So when you read people like Frank Jackson writing about roles and occupants, it's sometimes described, at least officially, as an attempt to work out what the best candidate is in the world for something that fits a role that's specified by our ordinary talk. That's part of what will be involved in Project 3 here. But as the case of politics frequently reminds us, it's often the case that the best candidate for something is not a particularly good candidate for something. And I think of that as a further part of Project 3, not just isolating the best candidate, but trying to work out how good a candidate that is. Now, talk of goodness just then was talk of goodness of fit for a role. There was nothing evaluative about it. But this reminds us of the possibility of a fourth project. So a fourth thing you might do is contemplate various kinds of reform, where these would be reform of the way we talk and the way we think about some particular part of the world. So having given an analysis of how the ordinary word cause works, having given an analysis of how the world runs, you might find yourself suggesting that we would do better to use the word cause differently or to come up with a quite different language. Now, this fourth project I see as requiring input of another kind. It doesn't follow from 1, 2, and 3 because it requires information about the purposes that lie behind use of the concept in question. So without information about what purposes a particular part of language is serving, there's no way of asking the question about whether you might be able to do better than the way you are presently doing. So, for example, if you want the word knowledge, the ordinary word knowledge, to function as a natural kind term, then one direction of reform might be suggested by a complete story with respect to projects 1, 2, and 3. But you might not want the word knowledge to function as a natural kind term. You might want it to be more of a practical tool which doesn't carry any kind of theoretical weight. So depending on what you want, what people want from the term, different directions of reform will be prompted. So, for example, context-sensitive features of words like knowledge and related features of words like cause, so recent work on the context sensitivity of attributions of causation, that may or may not prompt people to think about reform. If you're interested in a word like knowledge and a word like cause as potentially theoretically weight-bearing terms, then you might regard context sensitivity of attribution as a somewhat unfortunate thing, because it interferes in particular with convergence of people's judgments as evidence comes in. If, on the other hand, you treat these things as practical tools that are supposed to operate easily in real-time discourse, then there's nothing wrong with context sensitivity, and it might sometimes be a useful oiler of the wheels. So for each combination of facts of type 1, facts of type 2, facts of type 3, and a set of goals, there'll be directions of reform that are suggested. But I think that no amount of information less than that will suffice to motivate a direction of reform. So which kinds of goals might be relevant? Well, when considering reform, one kind of goal, of course, would be the actual goals that present-day users of a term have. And that then will be facts about what people's purposes are, what their goals are, will then be part of Project One. That will be part of the facts about usage. So one possible way things might go is Project One tells us how people use the word cause or the word no. Project Two tells us what the world is like with respect to the area that people are trying to deal with. Project Three gives us an account of how usage and the world are related. And because you know what people's goals are, you might then have some reason to contemplate reforms of various kind in Project Four. But of course, existing goals are one thing. We needn't feel bound by them. It'd be quite possible for a person to suggest that they want to reform the goals that are part of the patterns of usage that are studied in Project One. So a person might say, I realize that people use the word cause as a sort of low-key practical tool, but I want it to be a weight-bearing concept in a certain part of science. Whether or not, well, in a situation where that was not what people were doing up until now, I want to do it from now on. Then you will have a different set of goals coming in and a different possible direction of reform suggested. So I think of that as, that's an ideal. That's a sort of, if you had all of this, you wouldn't want for more with respect to the philosophical understanding of causation, knowledge, truth, moral goodness, whatever it is that you're interested in. This ideal is, of course, extremely impractical. We're assuming that a person can somehow gain empirical knowledge of all sorts of very subtle matters, including subtle psychological and linguistic facts. Now, that itself might not be a big deal. A person might say at this point that we can at least reasonably easily come up with approximations to a story with respect to facts, Project 1, Project 2, Project 3, and consequently think about Project 4. A little bit of incompleteness or falseness with respect to what we say about the first two sets of empirical facts need not matter too much, especially with respect to especially with respect to give a story about the relationships, the overall relationships between the way we talk in some area and the way the world is. Philosophical options with respect to the third option, the third project here, will often be somewhat coarse-grained. So there'll be some slippage with respect to the details. Several different packages with respect to one and two might give rise to a similar story with respect to three, and approximation is hence okay. Now that I think of as a reasonable response, and the story I'll be presenting in the talk is a continuation of that sort of way of thinking about the practical side of this ideal. But I think there are lots of ways to not quite do what I think ought to be done with respect to pursuing this ideal. And that's what I'll be talking about through other parts of the talk, mostly through examples. And the example I'll focus on from now on, almost all the way through, is causation, and in particular, the most influential body of work on causation in the last few decades, which is David Lewis's work. Okay, people here will be very familiar with a lot of what David Lewis said about causation, so I'll go quite quickly through this and try to focus just on the important parts. So Lewis's program was to achieve a certain kind of reflective equilibrium between a common sense view of the world, science, and demands of consistency and economy. So the aim was to give a certain kind of story about the relationship between what we say and what there is, but I think it was not an account It was not a program that fits the ideal that I was describing a moment ago. There were two pieces of the story. Firstly, an account of how we talk, an account of how we talk about causation, how we use the word cause, how we think about causation. And secondly, a picture of the world that we're talking about, where the phrase that Lewis used to summarize his picture of the world was a picture in which Humean supervenience holds. So the picture of the world that Lewis was working within was a picture in which the world consists of a mosaic of local matters of fact, where those local matters of fact are instantiations by particulars of natural properties. And the aim in practice in Lewis's work was to find good candidates in the Humean mosaic for causes, for laws, for cases of knowledge, for chances, and so on. So things we can be talking about when we use those terms. The example of causation is, of course, the one I'll be focusing on mostly. So how can there be causes in a world that consists entirely of a mosaic? Well, a mosaic world is, of course, a world in which, in some sense, there are loose and separate things, to use Hume's old phrase, that make things up, whereas causation is supposed to be a kind of cement or a connector. So the challenge is to find features of the mosaic that can be regarded as what we're talking about when we engage in causal talk. And the general strategy is to reduce facts about connectedness, causal connectedness, to facts about pattern, facts about the array of particular facts. And Lewis wanted to argue that special kinds of pattern suffice for there to be connectedness in the world of the sort that causation, as we ordinarily understand it, requires. Now, this was done via the use of counterfactuals and his analysis of counterfactuals. I'm not going to go into details about that. Instead, I want to focus on a particular part of Lewis's account, and here I'm going to pick up an argument given in a paper by Doug Kutach, where Kutach looks very closely at the pieces of Lewis's account and what role they're supposed to be, what role they're supposed to be playing. So Kutach asks, is Lewis trying to, in his account of causation, is he trying to describe some real goings-on in the world or some features of our ways of talking about what really goes on in the world? Is it a sociolinguistic enterprise or a more straightforwardly metaphysical enterprise? Now, the use of intuitions about counterexamples and intuitions about fanciful cases, the way that Lewis's account is guided by our intuitions and our intuitive judgments, suggests that he can't be trying to give a straightforward account of what the world contains. It must, in some sense, be an account of our psychology and our habits of talk. But many of Lewis's subtle and complex maneuvers are designed with a particular purpose, which is to avoid positing a fundamental temporal direction, a direction of time, that might ground certain asymmetries of influence and causation. And so there's a quote from Kutach's paper. So there's going to be a lot of quotes on the slides here, and I'm not going to read them all out, just going to go for the crucial bits. Kutach says that one of Lewis's motivations is to avoid positing a temporal direction, and to derive these asymmetries from facts about the contingent layout of historical fact. That makes sense if one's thinking about the account as part of a metaphysical or scientific project, but not if it's an account of how we talk and think. Because if you're purely concerned with project one, purely concerned with how we talk and think, then there's no need to say anything about the temporal asymmetry other than to say that people, ordinary people, have a strong sense of the importance of a temporal asymmetry and a flow from past towards future, and that guides much of what they say about causal matters. So Kutach thinks that what Lewis has given us is implausible as an account of what there is in the world because it's too much guided by intuitions about counterexamples, but also, so it's too shaped by linguistic details with respect to that side, but also implausible as an account of our everyday concept because it's too much tailor-made to fit with the details of the metaphysics side. Now, some people carrying on Lewis's tradition since then, perhaps partly in response to considerations like this, have suggested that Lewis is not describing our actual habits of talk, but a kind of cleaned-up relative of our habits of talk. So here's a quote from the introduction of the collection on causation and counterfactuals. edited by Collins, Hall and Paul, trying to ask what the project is that people are engaged in this area. And they say, well, one thing you might be doing is providing a good old-fashioned conceptual analysis. Now, as will be clear from the quote I just had up from Kutach, I don't think that's true, that is the best way of seeing what Lewis is doing. On the other hand, though, they think you might be trying to give a cleaned up and at least partly sanitized version of a causal concept that won't track our ordinary concept that precisely, but might serve some theoretical purpose. Now, that's a possible picture, but the odd part about the Collins et al. Story here is the idea that you can engage in this, what I would call project for enterprise, trying to talk about directions of possible form, without considering the purposes and goals to which causal talk is being put. So they say, it strikes us as a perfectly appropriate strategy for a philosopher to try to come up with a clean, elegant, and theoretically attractive account of causation in the reasonable expectation that such an account will serve some, possibly as yet undisclosed, philosophical or scientific purpose. Now, I guess I don't think of that as a reasonable way of thinking about the reformist project. You can't hope to get a useful tool in this way without having some sense of what it's for. So, for example, cleanness and elegance, Collins et al. Regard as sort of obviously desirable, and maybe they're obviously desirable ceteris paribus, but other things will tend not to be equal in this area. So I think that an account like this is ignoring the sort of purpose relativity of any attempt to sort of clean up or improve our notion of causal thinking. Okay, that's all on the linguistic side, and it's firstly a suggestion that Lewis and Lewis-influenced work is not following the ideal with respect to Project One. Let's now talk about the more overtly metaphysical side of things and the idea of Humean supervenience. So Humean supervenience, Lewis's view of what the world is like, has been probably the single most influential big metaphysical picture in recent discussion. And as I said earlier, it's a view of the universe as a kind of mosaic of local matters of fact, including only fundamental particulars and natural properties instantiated by those particulars, with the particulars arrayed in a space-time structure. Now, what is the status of this view of the world? Why should we work within it? Sometimes Lewis talks as if it's something he wants to argue for. He thinks it's something that at least cautiously we should believe in. So in a famous early passage, he says, years ago, I wrote that much of my work, actually I'm not sure if that's the right date for that, but it's the right date, sorry, yes. He said in 1994 that back in 86, he thought of his work as a campaign on behalf of Humean supervenience. The thesis that the whole truth about a world like ours supervenes on the spatio-temporal distribution of local qualities. I thought this campaign had been locally successful. So a campaign suggests he wants you to believe it. But Lewis accepts that Humean supervenience cannot be seen as a kind of philosopher's summary of the message we get from contemporary physics. So he notes explicitly that phenomena such as Bell inequalities suggest that there might be physical goings-on that violate the requirements of Humean supervenience. And there are other papers by philosophers of physics suggesting that there's a great deal going on in physics that is at odds with Lewis's picture. Now, Humean supervenience might be seen as a sort of philosophical summary of less exotic and older physics. Even that, however, is doubtful. So here's a useful summary of some arguments on this front given by various people summarized by Ned Hall. So, for example, spatial relationships obey the triangle inequality and appear to do so as a matter of necessity. But on a Humean supervenient view of the world, the facts about one set of spatial relationships between two things ought not to logically constrain the facts about other spatial relationships between other things, and consequently the triangle inequality comes out as a kind of contingent feature of the world rather than a necessary one. Now that might be seen as a problem with the details of Lewis's view itself rather than a feature of its intended status and role. And in this talk I'm talking mostly about what kind of role it's supposed to have. Another feature of Lewis's view, though, the one on the second passage on the slide there, I think is more problematic with respect to what its intended role is. So Lewis, in some of his discussions, gives an apparent role for aesthetic criteria in supporting a Humean supervenience picture. So he talks about things that don't fit Humean supervenience as rubbish. Now, on Project 2, as I understand it, the second part of the ideal I was describing, there's no role for aesthetic criteria unless we have some reason to believe that aesthetic criteria point towards truth. And the simple question, why shouldn't the world contain rubbish, is the appropriate one to ask. I mean, the world presumably will not contain impossible or incoherent rubbish, but there's plenty of coherent rubbish, and the fact that it's rubbish is no reason to think that the world doesn't contain it. Pressing on with Lewis, he also says at various points that there's a distinction between two different ways you might have of not believing Humean supervenience. You might not believe it for scientific reasons or for philosophical reasons. And all he wants to fight against is philosophical arguments. So the crucial part there is the red part on the slide. Now, the question to ask at that stage is, why should you... So Lewis says he wants to argue against philosophical impediments to believing a Humean supervenient picture. But why should you do that if it's not likely to be a true picture, in particular if the physics is pushing against it? So why is the conditional claim, you know, if Humeanism, then realism about causation, why is that conditionally important if there's no reason to believe that Humeanism is true? There's more along similar lines in the 1994 discussion. So Lewis says, the Humean picture is inspired by classical physics. Humean supervenience doesn't actually say that physics is right about what local qualities are, but that's the case to keep in mind. Well, if physics doesn't provide support for Humean supervenience, then why is it the case to keep in mind, rather than some other case? Why not keep some other case in mind? Now, Lewis might say at this point that he thinks that classical physics might be wrong in detail, but is probably right with respect to its outlines. He might say that, but he does not say that. And my understanding is that he never tied his defences of Humean supervenience to that claim, but he thinks classical physics is right in outline. So I think so far all of the things Lewis has said about why we should work within Humean supervenience are bad defences. I think the best thing he says on this point is something he says very, very briefly. So here's another quote, and the crucial part is in red there. So he says, the point of defending Humean supervenience is not to support reactionary physics, but to resist philosophical arguments that there's more going on than can be fitted in. And if he defends the philosophical tenability of Humean supervenience, that defense can doubtless be adapted to whatever better supervenience thesis may emerge from better physics. Now, that's possible, but it seems to require that you believe in a certain kind of continuity between classical and ideal physics. So it again seems to require that you think that that future physics will come out a certain way where there are strong assumptions being made. Brian Weatherson, in his Stanford Encyclopedia article on Lewis, he gives a defense of Humean supervenience that, as I see it, follows up this thread and does so in a somewhat different way, an interesting way. So here's what Weatherson says. So Weatherson says Lewis's defense gives us a recipe for locating gnomic, intentional, and normative properties in a physical world. And the crucial thing about it is not the fact that the world being pictured is particularly likely to be the real world, but that it is a very thin world. There's not much in it. Lewis's recipe is a recipe that uses remarkably few ingredients. It's likely that ideal physics will have more in it. And Weatherson says that the more there is in fundamental physics, the easier it will be to solve the location problem, whether that's the problem of locating things like causes and morals and chances in the furniture of the world, because the would-be locator has more resources to work with. Now, that's fleshing out what I think of as the best possible way of defending a Humean supervenience picture. I think that the details here, I mean, there are more steps. Well, there are problems here that Weatherson doesn't seem to take that seriously. So Weatherson takes it that if physics just adds lots of stuff, to the minimal Lewis world, it must necessarily make the problem easier. It's not possible that the stuff being added is antithetical to the way we ordinarily think about causation or chance and so on. So Weatherstone is thinking, he's writing here as if more is always better. But more is not always better, I take it, in this context. And if physics became sufficiently holistic, I think that would be that would make the location problem harder to solve rather than easier. So I think there are details here that are problematic. But as a general approach to the problem of justifying Cumie and supervenience, I see this as quite a lot better than the official things that Lewis said. But the way to describe what we're doing here is very different. I think a different language is usefully introduced at this point. So what Weatherstone is saying is we shouldn't work within Cumie supervenience because we think it's likely to be true, because we think the world is likely not to contain rubbish, because we think it's tenable. Rather, we should work within it because it provides a minimal model, a kind of useful minimal model of the universe. And there are we might be able to make arguments of the form, if we can solve the problem within the minimal model, we can expect to solve the problem within a richer picture of the universe that might come along later. And I think of that as a reasonable way to work. But if we start using that language, I think it motivates a switch to a quite different framework with respect to our thinking about these big metaphysical systems. And the epistemology of model building in general becomes relevant. So what I want to talk about for the next part of the talk is models and model building. Forgetting metaphysics. Suppose you're a social scientist or a biologist who is interested in cooperation, and you want to understand how cooperation can survive in an environment in which agents are generally rather self-interested and in which opportunities for exploitation reliably arise. And because you're a social scientist or biologist, the systems you're interested in are very complex, subject to all kinds of influences. Well, one thing you can do, and one thing that many people do at this stage, is describe an imaginary setup which has some of the core features that you care about. And having described the imaginary or hypothetical setup, you see how it will behave, and will eventually then try to bring the behaviors of your imaginary scenario back to the real-world target system you care about. Now, because the system you're describing is imaginary or hypothetical, there's a problem of constraint. It seems you could just sort of say anything. So a good way of constraining your discussion of the imaginary system is to tie it explicitly to some mathematical structure, or at least in some way to mathematically constrain your discussion of its behavior. So a very famous example of this kind of work is Robert Axelrod's 1981 book, The Evolution of Cooperation. So this is a book which has had a considerable influence in many parts of the social sciences and biology. It's been cited many thousands of times. It's really a sort of landmark book. So what does Axelrod do in this book? Well, he uses game theory broadly construed to understand the evolution of cooperation. And the point of the book is to show the power of simple forms of reciprocity in making it possible to maintain cooperation, even when immediate benefits can be gained by exploitation. So he famously discussed the power of a very simple strategy called tit for tat, which is a simple behavioral program in which can be exhibited by an agent of some kind in a situation in which there's possible gains from cooperation but also temptations on the part of partners to defect, where if you have an iterated interaction involving a pair of agents, where the choices are simultaneous on the part of the two agents, and formally speaking, the payoff situation is a prisoner's dilemma, but you can think about this more informally, just a situation in which there's some temptation to defect, but long-term gains possible by cooperating, then tit-for-tat is a strategy that starts out cooperating with its partner and then copies whatever the partner did on the previous trial. So it's a way of going through the world in which you start friendly, you retaliate quickly, and you forgive quickly as well. And Axelrod's method in his 81 book was to use a mixture of algebra and computer simulation to show the peculiar robustness of very simple forms of reciprocity, such as tit for tat, in making it possible to maintain cooperation in a potentially somewhat hostile environment. So in a typical situation, We assume a population with different kinds of individuals within it, playing different behaviors. There's some rule by which the individuals interact and receive payoffs, and some rule by which the population composition is updated according to the payoffs that individuals behaving in different ways receive. So the updating rule may involve something like wholly synchronized asexual reproduction, where you interact for a while, and then having interacted with individuals for a while, you asexually reproduce, create more individuals in a way that's synchronized with the rest of the population. Now, none of this happens in real life ever, anywhere. There are no populations, roughly speaking, that update themselves by exactly synchronized asexual reproduction. But that doesn't hurt the value of the work. What you can do is work out what kind of basic results can be found in this imagined system, and then start working out how to bring the hypothetical or idealized or imaginary phenomena you've observed or sort of proven back to real-world targets. Once you've done that, you can then start also adding complexity to the model, trying to narrow the gap between the real and the imaginary, knowing as you do so that you face a trade-off between complexity and tractability, where the more you add to the model, the less transparent its behaviors will be. Now, factual claims can be made of several different kinds within this work. So one kind of claim people can make is internal claims, claims made just within the model. So a person might say, this system will reach an equilibrium, or without non-random interaction, cooperation is doomed in this scenario. What are claims of that sort? They're not abstract claims about real-world systems. They're summary claims about classes of imaginary systems. What they say is true of no real system. They might be seen as broad generalizations that are very approximately true of some real-world systems. But what they look most like on the face of it is statements that are made within fictional contexts. So to say that in this simplified model situation, such and such will occur, looks on the face of it similar to saying in Sherlock Holmes's London, things are this way. They look a lot like statements that are made within fictional contexts. Now, on the philosophy of science side, that last claim is very controversial. A lot of people don't like the analogy between model systems and fictional worlds. And there are different ways of doing it, but you can see that there's a class here of internal claims, where you're talking wholly within the model. A second kind of claim is overt model-world comparison. So you aren't talking about behaviors within the model, you're talking about the structure of the model and its similarities and differences from real-world structure. You might say, well, here are the simplifications I've made of assumed asexual reproduction or of assumed random interaction. And here's how the things are in the real world. There's sex, things are non-random, and so on. So, for example, we might want to explain, as Axelrod did, the rise of unsanctioned cooperation across no man's land in the Western Front during World War I, where people in English and German trenches developed spontaneous cooperative arrangements. And there's genuine similarity between the simple computer program, tit for tat, and the rules that were being followed by soldiers in World War I scenarios. They were often initially friendly, quick to retaliate, quick to forgive. But you can easily state various things that are disanalogies between what's true in the model and what's true in World War I. For example, choices were not simultaneous in the real world, and the updating rule was very different from the updating rule that you have in the models. You can then also, having understood the model system and described similarities and differences between model system and real world, start making further claims about the actual case on the basis of the model. So the upshot of a model, its new content, can often be expressed with a conditional. A person might say, what we've learned from this modeling exercise is that in a situation in which X holds, then Y will occur. Now, the antecedent here, you know, if things are X, is not true of the actual world. Things are never like that in the actual world, but the conditional is supposed to be true, or supposed to have whatever kind of top grade of epistemic value that conditionals about non-actual scenarios can have. And you might also then note that although X doesn't apply exactly in the actual world, approximately X does apply in the actual world. So what you know so far is that if X, then Y, and approximately X. And then you'll then wonder if you can infer approximately Y. Now, this won't be guaranteed just from the conditional and from approximately X, but sometimes it's okay. And part of the craft of the modeler is trying to work out when you can be confident that once you know if X, then Y, and approximately X, you can infer something about the approximate Y-ishness of situations in the real world. So that's a sort of quick sketch of a distinctive style of work seen in various parts of science, and some initial comments about the epistemology and the philosophy of science that goes along with it. And this kind of model building is ubiquitous in biology, social science, also areas like climate science, and so on. And I think that this is a way of thinking about the appropriate use of some of the big systems in metaphysics. Now, in philosophy, of course, there are lots of places in which there's an obvious role for the imaginary. So there are things like the social contract, there are thought experiments, there are famous imaginary cases of various kinds, in which the imaginary has an obvious role. But there's usually taken to be a contrast between things like that and things like Lewis's mosaic picture of the world, which is an attempt to not engage in any kind of fictional activity, but to say how he thinks, in summary, things really are. And I think given the kinds of pressure that can be put on systems of this kind, a better way to think of many of them is to think of them as model systems of this kind. So in the scientific case, like the evolution of cooperation, people are faced with immense complexity. And in the face of complexity, they idealize. They imagine a more tractable and simpler analog of a system they're interested in. In the metaphysics case, we are faced with complexity, but also just with the sheer, the monumental size of the subject matter. And here again, I think, as in science, one thing that the philosopher's imagination tends to do is we find ourselves model building. And as in science, sometimes we do this without sort of fully realizing what we're doing. I think the ideology of theorizing and the practice of theorizing in parts of philosophy can be somewhat at odds with each other. But in both cases, when faced with a certain kind of intractable problem, one thing our minds do is begin to imaginatively modify it to yield a tractable one. The results, okay, so what results from this? One way of thinking about the results of this is that it provides a practical way to pursue the ideal that I was describing in the first part of the talk. So here is a project that would make good sense. We want to pursue the ideal. Projects 1, 2, 3, and 4. 1 and 2, of course, have, they're in principle empirical contingent matters, and the sheer size of the body of factual information in both cases is enormous, even aside from the intractability of many of the facts. But one thing we can hope to do is idealize with respect to both the facts of type 1 and facts of type 2, in a way that yields a definite outcome with respect to facts of type 3, in a way that gives us a picture of the relationships between our concepts and patterns of talk and the way the world works on the other hand, and then try to give a principled argument that our conclusions regarding 3 will be robust, that the idealizations we've made with respect to projects 1 and projects 2 don't undermine what we have done with respect to the conclusions withdrawn with respect to project 3. So we try to argue that the conclusions withdrawn with respect to 3 are robust to reasonable modifications of what we assumed with respect to 1 and 2. And this, in different language, is roughly what Weatherson did with respect to Humean supervenience. He tried to give a certain kind of robustness argument, where the argument was that, this is now putting it in modelese, the modifications we made to give rise to a model of the universe were in the direction of a minimal model, and when you add stuff back in, you can't make things worse. So the conclusions we draw about 3 should stay put once we move from the minimal model to a richer universe. Now, I said that I think that Weatherson's, the details here are questionable, but the strategy, I think, is a reasonable strategy. But having pursued it, I think the way to think about it is in terms of the distinctive epistemology of modeling. Okay, there's two more topics I was going to cover. We did start a little late. How much time do I have left, roughly?
You've now been talking for about 40 minutes, and so I think it'd be a good idea to wind up reasonably quickly.
Five or so?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, so I'll just pick one of the two topics I was going to talk about. Yeah, I'll just pick the first one, then I'll stop. One more sort of topic, interesting point of detail that follows up here. So when talking about the sorts of maneuvers and modifications that people make when modeling, I've been emphasizing sheer simplicity as what people are heading towards. But that's not always the case. And there are different ways of choosing to modify imaginatively an actual situation to make it more modelable, which don't always involve, or don't only involve the direction of simplicity. So there can be direction, there can be moves made in the direction of tractability, which are not always moves in the direction of simplicity. And I think that in science, a great deal of modeling is done in a way that shapes an imaginary system around available methods, where of the many modified analogues of a real system that might be considered, the ones that are chosen tend to be ones that lend themselves to available methods. So, for example, when formal work in science was always analytic, then assumptions of continuity were popular. When computers become useful, then assumptions of discreteness can be made. Now, one of the deeper everyday proverbs, I think, that floats around is the proverb, to someone who only has a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Now, of course, not everything is in fact a nail, but there's a legitimate modeling maneuver that can be done where a person says, given how great my hammer is, I'm going to pretend that all these things are nails and see how far I get. And part of the craft of modeling is trying to work out when such a procedure or strategy goes too far. So here's another argument. Okay, we've lost a slide. Not quite sure why. So I'll just put that up and continue. An argument that Ned Hall makes, a separate argument against Humean supervenience, goes along the following lines. In Lewis's discussion of Humean supervenience, the things that are supposed to attach to property, to particulars, are always taken to be natural properties. Whereas in science at the moment, it's more natural to think about physical magnitudes, the values of variables, as the property-like things that science recognises. And all sorts of puzzles arise in Lewis's framework because you're committed to the idea that any two properties in principle, if they're basic and natural, can either be co-instantiated or not co-instantiated. There's free recombination with respect to natural properties as they might attach to a particular object. So as a consequence of that, it's not even obvious in a Humean supervenient picture why it is that an object can't be 5 kilograms and 7 kilograms simultaneously. Hall ties this to the influence of predicate logic and the idea that as philosophy has developed through the 20th century and as philosophers like Lewis have become accustomed to working, predicate logic becomes the preferred format for expressing anything. And as a consequence of that, the naturalness of physical magnitudes becomes hard to recognize. So just as for someone who only has a hammer, everything looks like a nail, for someone who thinks always in terms of predicate logic, everything looks like it's an array of objects that instantiate natural properties rather than an array of objects that in which variables have values. I'll finish with a brief historical remark that's more general. When you look at Lewis's work and what it comes out of, you can see it as a continuation of a general trend that operates through sort of large parts of the Western tradition to look for atomist stories whenever possible. So in physics, atomism was popular long before there was real evidence for it. In philosophy, Locke and Hume were, of course, influenced by Newton and tried to introduce atomist pictures in mind and epistemology. And 20th century logical atomism of the sort seen in Russell is a continuation of the same trend. Now, in Russell, if you read Russell's early work on this topic, the move that Russell made reflected both metaphysical dissatisfaction with the monist views of 19th century idealism and also a sense that so much could be done with new methods deriving from mathematics and logic that work within an atomist picture. So this is the power of thinking in terms of sets, quantification, relations between distinct things. These new methods came to have immense appeal. And through the 20th century, topics that had previously seemed to generate nothing but rubbish in metaphysics could become the basis of cumulative work. So atomism is a sort of peculiarly usable metaphysics in contrast with various others. A rough contemporary of Russell's, John Dewey, made, I think, a very smart remark about these sorts of choices in his book Experience and Nature. So here's expressed in somewhat different language what I think of as a modelish insight that John Dewey had when writing about the systems that faced philosophy in the early part of the 20th century. So Dewey saw philosophical systems as generally the consequences or the products of what he called selective emphasis, which is understood like this. As Dewey saw it, in ordinary experience, we come across a great mixture of goings-on, a great mixture of kinds of things. And philosophical systems often arise because a person, for various reasons having to do with the historical context, the skill set they have, their cast of mind, and so on, will seize on some particular part of ordinary experience and try and build everything out of it, use it as a basis to construct everything. Parts of experience other than the aspect chosen then receive some mixture of reduction, elimination, and deflation. And as Dewey, this is a nice quote from Dewey, as Dewey saw it, this is the source of those astounding differences in philosophic belief that startle the beginner and become the plaything of the expert, where each is driven by the skill set and in some ways the social concerns of its own time. Now, in the case of Humean supervenience-like pictures of the world and more holistic pictures of the world, Dewey had roughly the following picture. He thinks that ordinary experience contains a mixture of both. It contains the genuinely discrete and the genuinely connected. And in different times in philosophy, people will seize on one or the other. In the 19th century, people seized on the connectedness of parts of experience and built great systems out of that. In the 20th century, people seized on the discreteness of aspects of experience and built a great system out of that. As Dewey saw it, one thing that I've been suggesting about Lewis, Russell and co. is that one asymmetry that's real here is that more can be done with a metaphysics that's atomistic. The discreteness lends itself to cumulative work of a kind that holistic metaphysical pictures don't. Dewey would say at this point, though, that with respect to the status of the models themselves, a more atomistic and a more holistic model, there's not really much to choose between them. Ordinary experience still contains the same mixture of the discrete and the atomistic. One difference that I would have from Dewey is the following. When Dewey asserts that kind of symmetry, he's taking it, I think, that science, physics in particular, but science in general, could not in principle come down on one side or the other. I think he thinks that the mixture of the discrete and the connected in experience will stay put, roughly speaking, after science has done its job. And that I don't think is true. And I think that's a difference between the sort of naturalism that I would endorse and the kind of naturalism that Dewey would endorse. But it would be the pure project to scientific body of information that would yield an answer with respect to the truth being closer to the atomistic or the truth being closer to the holistic picture of the universe. I don't think that the standard metaphysical discussions of the sort I've been talking about suffice to do that. Okay, I'll stop there.
Thank you, Peter. Just in case there's anyone here not familiar with local conventions, the question period runs on the hand finger convention, which means that if you want to ask a question, raise your hand, I'll put you on the queue. If you want to make a small point on the existing discussion, you can raise a finger, and if it looks like there's going to be time, then you can jump the queue, as it were. But don't try, it's called finger abuse if you try and use your finger to start the talk. And that's severely frowned on. Okay, Toby.
I'm sympathetic to many of the worries you had about Lewis lots of project one on the basis of conceptual analysis and so on, assume something like project three, assuming a referentialist kind of picture of how language works, we can show it doesn't follow that the world contains various aesthetically unpleasing things under the heading of project two. So projects one and three entail a negative thesis about project two, that is, that it's tenable to defend a humane sort of world. That's how I think of Lewis's project, so it's kind of interesting to know what you think about that. But mainly I want to know, what's the appeal of your model-based version of Lewis's project?
It's not supposed to be an interpretation of Lewis, it's supposed to be criticism of Lewis. So the idea is, the structure is supposed to be like this. I'm hoping that people will agree with the statement of the ideal. Forget any other philosopher who's ever been around, just think, what would we do if we were starting again? With respect to roughly speaking, the tasks that analytic philosophers are concerned with, what's causation, what's knowledge, and so on. So the first argument is, this is a good statement of the ideal. If we were able to do this, we would have done our job as well as it could have been done. And consequently, if there are styles of work and patterns of work that push away from this, that's an argument against them, if they lead towards something other than this ideal. I take this to be the ideal, not just an ideal, I guess, but the ideal. This is all the information that we could want, and it organizes the information in the right way. So that's the first point. Then the argument is that with the ideal in place, you can see that Lewis's work, which is the most influential work in this general area in the last several decades, has some things in common with the structure of the ideal, but has definite departures as well. You can see definite places where there are choice points and he does not follow this ideal, does something else. And then the argument is that that's bad. So it's not supposed to be an interpretation of what he was really doing. I think he was really doing roughly what you say he was really doing, but he shouldn't have been doing that. That's the argument. But did you want to follow up with with the last thing you said? Because
no,
I wasn't sure.
You said that he was doing roughly what I thought he was doing, so that's very satisfying.
Okay.
Carlos.
I guess I also wanted to follow up on that and say about Project 1 and Project 2. I don't see this as an ideal that we should be aspiring to. And I have a problem with the separation of 1 and 2. In particular, the idea that might be able to describe use and practice without describing the world, in particular the parts of the world that the term might be referring to. So I don't like the idea that we should be we'll always be able to separate out project one and project two. So as a picture of what the analytic project is, I don't think this is a neat way of doing it necessarily. And Lewis too, I think. One thing that perhaps Tony was also thinking is that Lewis is thoroughly quining, and that comes out in lots of different ways in his methodology. But I think that the right way to think of the Humean supervenience doctrine is as a quining posit, and which has it's threatened by putative phenomena like the normative, the intentional, etc. But his job is, in argument, was to show how it's not actually threatened by those phenomena. It's actually consistent with those phenomena, and that's where the dialectic goes in his work. It tends to be trying to show that what's taken to be reasons for junking the mosaic picture is not actually that you can still find. Place for these phenomena in a mosaic world. On your point about the special role of classical physics, I wish I could remember this now, but I remember talking with David about that, and he was very keen on the fact that classical physics gave really good accounts of the middle-sized objects and the way they behave, and he actually referred to a paper
Let me pick up the first thing you said in particular. So you think the separation between Project 1 and Project 2 I'm describing is not viable. So here's...
It's not guaranteed.
Well, here's a simple example from a section I cut. So take the word knowledge and know. Here's a sketch of a Project 1. Here's a sketch of some facts of Type 1. Knowledge is true belief based on evidence that rules out all relevant alternatives. That's a kind of one sentence description of facts of type one. I'm just summarizing a family of views. Knowledge is true belief based on evidence that rules out all relevant alternatives. What that means is people will call something knowledge if they regard it as true belief based on evidence that rules out all relevant alternatives. That's what people treat to be knowledge. And we don't yet, we haven't said a word about the world, whether there is such a thing.
We just talked about the world.
No, so, well, if there is knowledge, then it is true belief based on evidence that rules out all relevant alternatives. That would be a more accurate statement. That's what the concept requires, or that's what involves. And then someone can come along. So here's a discussion that took place at Stanford, a meeting of two universes in philosophy, which was very interesting. It was a conference to celebrate the retirement of Fred Dretske. And Dretske thinks he has a sort of analysis of knowledge in which if something is knowledge, then it's true belief based on evidence that rules out all relevant alternatives. And he just took that to be a fact about the concept of knowledge. And Pat Soupies was there, who's very much a kind of Project 2 guy to his bones. And Soupies said, well, fine, Fred, if that's what you think knowledge is, then there isn't any. The world just does not contain any such thing. And each of them tried to push the other in a particular way. Fred tried to say to Pat, look, what you're saying, well, he's saying, we are sure there's knowledge. So if you tell me that the world doesn't contain relationships between events such that it's possible for evidence to rule out all relevant alternatives, I'm pretty sure there's something wrong with what you're saying. And Soupies was saying to Dretske, given how sure I am about how the world works, given that I think that the notion of knowledge is a viable concept, there must be something wrong with your analysis of how the concept works. And I guess I think that they could have both been right. And it's wrong to try to get one project to intrude in the ways that they were supposing was possible on the other. It might well be, this is like a John Mackey point about ethics, it may well be that the concept of knowledge involves a certain kind of true exclusion of alternatives. And it may well be that the physical world never does that for us. And then that's a fact of type three, and that's just the way things are.
Now, notice what I said was not that you can never separate them, but that you can't always separate them. And it may be that this is a case where you can separate them. But, for example, thinking about causation is, I think, a nice case where where it is harder to separate them. To merely describe the use in practice, as it were, non-causally, counterfactually or conditioned the way you tried to, I actually think those conditionals aren't actually describing real use in practice. The first project is actually a descriptive project about the way our terms are used. And that's a real phenomenon in the world. And it might be that in describing that real phenomenon in the world, we actually use the concept that we're trying to give an account of. And that might be inevitable. I think causes a case where that's very plausible, or some of the normative notions as well. So it might be that there are concepts that you can separate, but I doubt that you can do it in general.
And I think if that happens, that's just the way it goes in that case. I don't think that's a problem with the ideal. Suppose we work out that we can't give an account of some aspect of our practice without presupposing the viability of that practice in giving the account of the facts of type 2, then we just observe that that's what happened. And that's, I mean, I think such claims are massively overstated and overrated in philosophy, but if they happen, if it happens, it happens. I think that's just an outcome or a result of the analysis. It's not a problem with the style of analysis. Where best is true. That's a test of the metaphysical view.
Right, so it's a kind of, so my sort of proposal is that ideal, perfectly good as it is only a way of answering one kind of philosophical question, and one way to think of Lewis is to be not answering that question, but to be setting out his stall. Here's my grand thesis about the ultimate nature of the universe. Now let's try and figure out whether that thesis is true. And that, it seems to me, you can't fit into that.
There was a step where I really wondered about how it was going to go. So we've got our metaphysical picture, and at a certain point you said we're going to test it. Now, fitting in with how we ordinarily talk, I don't think of as a very good test of a metaphysical picture.
Oh, yeah. So what is...
Okay, then I think, so Lewis thinks it is. Then I say to Lewis, why is it? I mean, what story can you tell me about the connection between how we ordinarily talk and the ultimate nature of things would give me confidence that I can draw these inferences from how we ordinarily talk to the nature of things? And then I think he gets into the... Then I think he runs out of things to say quite quickly. Yeah. So I agree that that's... It's not that I'm giving an interpretation of what... it's not a rational reconstruction of him. It's a criticism of him. And I'm wondering whether you think... If there is a different way of doing an ideal that's genuinely distinct and doesn't have these problematic steps in it, then I'd be interested to hear it. But in the version you just gave, there seemed to be a step that was a problem step.
Oh. Seems perfectly fine.
Well, the argument, yeah, the argument is, here's what I think of as the ideal, and if someone has a better ideal, an alternative ideal, then tell me. And Lewis tells me, and I say, well, that's not a good ideal because it's got these steps that are problematic. And insofar as your ideal diverges from mine, it's got these steps that are problematic. That's where I take it we're at. And then what I want to hear, I guess, is either a story about why the steps were not problematic, or a third possible ideal which does not have problematic steps. It is possible that I didn't express the global structure of this well enough. So the idea is, we're all supposed to agree that although we talk differently, we do things in different orders, we do things in big chunks or small chunks, and we use different methods, we all agree as analytic philosophers that with respect to the major topics, if we had this, we'd have everything. And the problem is, this is impractical, and how can we approach it in a practical way? And I think that the Lewis road is not a good road if you're after this. If you're after a different total package of information, then I start to raise objections to the relationships between parts of that alternative. That's the structure. It's supposed to be critical in that way. Okay, if the problem with two is where the borders are between two for this problem and two for that problem, so if the problem is, in the case of causation, we all agree that that physical laws and events and transfer of momentum and things like that are at least relevant, and we might wonder where it stops being relevant to causation. This is something I cut from the paper. When a question of that form arises, I think you should always just expand. You can never include too much. If a person says, well, I think you can't understand causation unless you look closely at our concept of proper behavior, some normative stuff, and an account of causation that ignores the normative will fail. If a person says that, I say, okay, fine. Put that in as well. That's part of the relevant, that's within the boundaries of Project 2. It's only practical considerations that make us want to keep 2 small. And if someone has an argument that 2 for some particular problem has to be expanded, then we expand. Now, one way to have a kind of, one philosophical attitude, which I'm not quite sure what name to ascribe to this, I mean, there's almost a certain kind of Wittgensteinian attitude that says, look, all of our practices are so knotted together that if you try to sort of give isolated stories, and if you especially try to reform in isolation, forget it, you just will sort of miss the boat. That's a sort of possible attitude. You might have a sort of holistic perspective on all of our practices that makes this project very hard to sort of pursue in practice. I still think that the ideal would be intact. To such a person, I would say, all fine, then. We then, in order to understand causation and knowledge and truth, have to give a colossal Project One story about all of our practices and give a complete physical account of the world. and talk about how this enormous thing in factor type 1 relates to this enormous thing in factor type 2. I still think that is the ideal that leaves nothing out.
I've got a finger and a hand, and they're sort of connected, as these things often are. The finger is an example to illustrate what I think is one of the things that's going on in some of these comments. And it's, in a sense, it's an objection to what I think you were just suggesting about this sort of expansionist approach to Project 2. I mean, suppose you have somebody whose intuitions about some aspect, some piece of modality like causation is a kind of Humean projectivist one. Now, you can fit that sort of project into this picture, but one thing you certainly don't want to do is expansionist at the Project 2 stage, because on the contrary, that sort of person is interested in showing that a sort of bare, rather non-modal conception of the world can nevertheless explain our modal practice, because on the understanding that the modal practice is not doing the job of tracking some element of the world.
Oh, sure. So expansion, just clarificatory. When I say expansion, I just mean bringing in stuff that looks as if it's part of a different problem, not adding stuff to one's picture of the facts of type 2. So quasi-realist and projectivist attitudes I take to be, you know, part of the target here. If a person says, I can give you a full account of which features of our usage in relation to the way the world actually is, a very minimal picture of the physical world, prompt and sustain a certain kind of modal discourse, that's a complete account. That's a sort of successful piece of project.
That's right. I think it fits in this general schema quite well.
And if then someone says, well, surprisingly enough, we're not going to be able to handle this question about modality unless we simultaneously handle a question about moral norms, then we just say, fine, bring, you know, wheel the two next to each other.
Okay. No, I approve of that. I thought what you were suggesting was expanding the picture of the world.
No, right. That wasn't something I didn't express clearly enough.
Okay, and so now the question in my hand was, it's really a suggestion. I think a friendly suggestion about something else you can see in Lewis, at least in some of these cases, you can see in Lewis as an argument for the Humean picture. And that, if you remember what he says about chance, he says something like, come up with your non-Humean whatnots if you like, but don't call them chance unless you can justify the principle. And another way of putting that is to say, unless you can explain the relevance of that non-Humean whatnot to decision theory.
Right.
So that's an obvious tie to what you're calling Project 1. And it's an obvious kind of pragmatic constraint, namely that the metaphysics has to be constrained by pragmatics in the sense of what we do with the concepts concerned, and that's a case in which Lewis is using it to support the Humean picture, and roughly, I suppose, the idea is that it's. I mean, he says something like he can see roughly how that explanation goes if we think of chance in terms of frequencies. So if you have this rather bare physics-driven Humean ontology, then you've got some idea as to how that practical constraint can be satisfied. But if you introduce chance as some kind of primitive, then Lewis thinks that you can't. Now, I think it's a very interesting question whether Lewis is consistent. I think that actually, he sort of fails to apply that constraint to his own views in the case of causation in a rather interesting way. But it's certainly true of some cases that there's this factor, this rather pragmatic factor, which is operating as a constraint on the metaphysical picture. It is operating in support of Humean, the kind of Humean picture, and I think it fits into this kind of structure quite nicely.
When you say constraint on the metaphysical picture, actually, I think I should ask you about this after, because I'm going to ask you to go through a few steps of it again, and it will take us a long time for me to do it now.
Okay, but I mean, that's a case in which it can be done. And it can be supported by you know, pieces of the text in Lewis. So there is this move of as it were, constraining one's metaphysics by some of the things that we do with the concepts.
Maybe this is what I'm wondering about. So constraining there only means arguing against arguments to expand. So if someone says, I want to expand my facts of type 2 to include chances of a certain kind.
Yeah, sort of
Lewis will say,
chances.
Yeah, I reply to you that what you say we need to introduce here is not going to do the job that you think it's going to do because it doesn't fit with the principle.
Not quite that, but they're saying, look, it's a constraint on that expansion that you should be able to explain why the extra bit you're putting in satisfies the principle.
Yeah, I'm sort of battling to... I think I need to sort of think through this one on my own a bit before replying further.
Okay, we started a bit late. I think we've got time for one more question. Alison.
So, really two questions. One of them is, could you think about... It seems to me that you could think about an alternative ideal, which is related to what Helen was saying, which would be an ideal where you just do project 4, right? You sort of ignore project 1. But, so you could just say, what I'm doing is very theoretical physics. What I'm doing is just trying to figure out what's the conceptual vocabulary that will do the best job of explaining all the things that we know.
Sorry, is it 2 or 4?
2. Well, so you just sort of go straight to reform, right? So you say, what I'm going to do is take what ideas that I know from physics, and I'm going to try and provide a high-level conceptual account of that, and that will be my metaphysics. So what I'm doing is really just very theoretical physics, the same way that a good physicist...
Oh, I think that's pure 2.
Or 2. The real question is, when does project... So the objection to something like Lewis is, well, if that's the project, then why on earth do you care whether an example about double prevention comes out one way or comes out another way? It seems like that's just completely irrelevant to that project. If you really were serious about saying, I just want to do the metaphysical project. So it does seem to me that there's another philosophical ideal you could have, but if you had that philosophical ideal, you would not be doing things like analyzing use and practice in the way that Lewis does, or treating that as if that was relevant to that second ideal.
I think I'm hearing this differently from you because... suppose a person says, I agree that there is the possibility of doing all of 1, 2, 3, and 4, and all I care about is 2. I don't care about anything but 2. 2 is everything to me. And in the sort of larger history of philosophy before the 20th century, going back, most people were 2 people. 1 and 3 are sort of very 20th century. That's why we talk about analytic philosophy specifically. You could do systematic metaphysics and not analytic philosophy, and done in a naturalistic spirit, that would give you a complete story on 2. And if you don't care about 1 and 3, that's your choice. But such a person doesn't disbelieve in 1 and 3. They think people do talk in certain ways, and you know, I'm sure Nietzsche didn't care what people said. He just wanted to work out what he thought was going on. But he didn't deny that people had these habits.
I mean, the point is just, you could imagine that could be one of the projects that philosophy could do, is just essentially do sort of skip 1 and 3 and just do 2 with an eye to 4 and do 2 in a very abstract conceptual, highly,
I'm regarding 4 as...
I'm
taking it you couldn't do 4 without doing 1, because you can't reform unless you know what your starting point is. So there we might disagree a bit. I think it's just a question of a minor point, that as I'm thinking about it, 4 is the reform of 1. And a person might just not care about how we talk, and they might just... they might just pursue 2 purely. So in some ways Armstrong's metaphysics as compared with Lewis's metaphysics is a little bit like that. I don't think David Armstrong cares that much about how people talk, to nothing like the same extent that David Lewis cares about how people talk. Sort of fitting in ordinary conceptions carefully with linguistic attention is a Lewis thing much more than it is an Armstrong thing in various other people. Yes, I don't think we disagree. I'm just thinking that four cannot be freestanding because it's the reform of one.
Well, here's a something related point, which is it problematic for this picture if you think that part of what actually establishes use in practice implicitly is an attempt to conform to an ideal that's like the ideal that you're presenting as this ideal? So if you think that part of what happens in development, for example, is that you... children, say, start out with a concept, check it against what they find out about the world, get new information about the world, revise the concept on the basis of how well they think the concept fits, the information that they get from the world, and so forth. So that this kind of constructivist revisionist process is actually what's happening, and has presumably happened historically as well in ordinary use and practice. Does that make that question about what use and practice is more problematic?
I don't think so. I think one's supposed to include the complete psychology, including developmental psychology. So the kid starts out not using the word cause, and at a certain point the kid starts using the word cause, and there's a process by which they go from the first to the second stage, and that's part of use and practice, how you get it. Now, if how you get it is theory-driven in the way that you say, right, that if it's evidence driven in the way that you say, then sort of responsiveness between practice and the world is part of what leads to normal use on the part of the kid. I'm not hearing that as a problem with the sort of ideal. It's just a sort of certain. It's a certain story about how an aspect of use and practice develops.
But it would mean that use and practice would be sort of a moving target.
There's a separate kind of moving targetness, which I'm not quite sure how to think about, where where views about three affect the ordinary development of one. You know, people think to themselves, my God, well, take, a person might say that ordinary moral discourse has changed as a consequence of people worrying about the objective basis of morality. And that's a new one fact, which is a consequence of their own reflection on three. You know, I think, my God, I'm not talking about anything real here. This is just all made up. It's just superstition. Those are all three claims made on the part of ordinary people, which can then affect use and practice. And that, yeah, I'm not quite sure how to think about that one. Yeah.
Okay, I think that's a good place to wind up for lunch. So let's thank Peter for taking Now, before you leave, a couple of administrative things. Firstly, we're only 10 minutes late, so we'll start again 10 minutes late at 1:40. Secondly, there's a dinner this evening at Aki's, a favorite Indian restaurant down on Waterloo Wharf, to which you're all welcome to come. People accept speakers, it'll cost you about $50. And if you'd like to come, please tell me now.